This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. For many people, February is a time to reflect on the contributions of African Americans to our nation. And on the Facebook Live show Intelligently Ratchet, co-hosts Kevin Thomas and Kareem Jarrett, a.k.a. Kazi and Bishop Omega, are holding a space for everyday people to participate in conversations about Black history. The goal of the show is to move away from the ivory tower and find out what other North Carolinians, including local politicians and artists, have to say. This month, Intelligently Ratchet will host and participate in a number of community events for Black History Month. And here to talk about all that and much, much more is Kevin Kazi Thomas. Kazi also broadcasting this conversation right now on the Intelligently Ratchet Facebook page. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank. Appreciate it.
What kind of, this is an interesting, because I know there are conversations within Black communities about Black History Month, within white communities, and then, of course, there are cross-cultural conversations about this. What are you hearing about the value and the importance or the lack of it for Black History Month?
Yeah, I think that Black History Month is very important because the conversation to me is how it's important. It's not just Black history, it's American history, right? I think about growing up and what I learned in our American education system. It took until about middle school for me to start being presented with information about who Dr. King was, why we had a holiday, and even leading up to that, the context of what you learn about African American history in our public school system kind of just relates to slavery, kind of just relates to the civil rights movement, and doesn't touch on any of the contributions that so many great educators, inventors, and other people have contributed to the grand scale and grand tapestry of what makes us America. You know, I think people think that it's like, oh, why do we have to have a Black History Month? We don't have a White History Month, or why is this important? I think for the fact that our own president spoke about Frederick Douglass like he was still alive, you know, and then you have, you know, some of the problems that you've seen go on continually where people identify with African Americans and that a criminal aspect, an athletic aspect, where there's like these narratives of where you fit in our society. And we don't touch on enough some of the, you know, the people and the figures that made America great, that helped build America into what it is. And just to honor their tradition and what they contributed.
Well, you grew up in or went to, we talked about middle school, about the first time you got a real good sense of African-American history, but also conversations with your white friends in Northern Virginia eliminated for you just how little all of us know.
Yeah, the first time that I remember, I was like fifth grade, you know, coming up then and we had, you know, we're like, yeah, we're off of school. You don't have to go to school on Martin Luther King Day. And I asked, you know, one of my white friends, I was like, yeah, you know who Martin Luther King is? He's like, yeah, he was one of the greatest singers of all time.
All right.
You know, and that just kind of highlights, you know, a bigger problem, I think, of the ignorance that we have about each other's cultures.
There's another critique, okay? There's a critique, let's call it on the right, that say, well, you know, we don't have White History Month, so why do we have Black History Month? So there's a kind of conservative critique that we don't need this, that we're in a post-racial.
Sure.
There's also a kind of progressive critique that I've heard as well. And that goes like this, that we still don't know about Martin Luther King, and that sometimes these months have a way of sanitizing it, because every television station, which may not be dominated by African-American management, and every newspaper, which is not dominated by African-American talent, will sanitize that version of him and make him look like a very nice man who thought we should all live together, when he was in fact a radical who had some very powerful ideas that actually cost him his life.
Right. Yeah, I feel like that, you know, a lot of times people want to like separate, you know, the hard part of the conversation, right? And that nobody was perfect, you know. And I'm not here to say, you know, that Dr. King was perfect or and you know anything like that. But when I see that somebody sacrificed what they believed in, you know, sacrificed their own lives for what they stood for and what they believed in, and led the inspiration that we would continue that fight. You have people like Reverend Barber now, who's continuing that fight for equality and now a war on poverty. You know, you're starting to see young voices with Black Lives Matter movement, and just outside of that, women, LGBT communities, all people of color, and what they're in the last 8 months in this presidency of what people have felt like they needed to rally for and why it's important their voice to be heard. If Dr. King isn't like the perfect example of how to do that, to go about that peacefully, because what his movement started out, you know, a lot of people will say it was basically for African Americans, but that became, there were brothers and sisters in the struggle of all races, nationalities.
Well, it was precisely when he made the radical arguments about our system, the systemic violence that our corporate state has become.
Right.
I mean, he was pointing a finger at capitalism, which was at the root of slavery.
Right.
There is slavery because corporations needed it 400 years ago in order to profit. And when he started to put his finger on that and rally white and black
right.
workers together against the corporate power structure, that's a radical statement, but also one that we needed to hear and still need to hear because it was true then and is true today. And we don't always get that when we get the little posters of Martin Luther King saying he has a dream,
right?
You know, which was also part of his part of his message.
Yeah.
But you're also looking at what's happening today as well, and I know you're going to co-host a lot of conversations on Intelligently Ratchet and wanted to bring the community conversations as well.
Yeah.
And you've taken part in a number of events. Tell us about the screening of Wilmington on Fire.
Yeah, so Wilmington on Fire will be screening at Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill on Sunday, February 18th. A documentary film that highlights the massacre, which a lot of people don't know about, the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. And basically, this is something that, you know, I'm also have roots in Eastern North Carolina. And about 20 minutes from Wilmington, 30 minutes from Wilmington. And you always hear stories and narratives about how Wilmington used to be, of how the ports and the downtown area were controlled by African-Americans. And there was a lot of African-American prominent business owners in that town. And how that dynamic shifted is something that you're not taught. There hasn't been any story that kind of lays that out. I've just kind of heard information from old people here and there and people that pass information. So what the brothers have done, I talked to one of the producers, Kent Chatfield, earlier today, is they put together this documentary. They've compiled all this evidence historically from public record, and they've had some pushback from the state, actually, that that they didn't want this story to really be told. But it's once again, the reason that we bring forth history, we don't want it to repeat itself. I think, you know, a documentary like this reminds us, okay, that, you know, it happened here in North Carolina. It wasn't just Tulsa. It wasn't just Rosewood. That we have our own history here in North Carolina. And so when we're talking about laws being gerrymandered, when we're talking about body cams being taken away, okay, 1898, this is, you know, we have some basis here, contextual basis for why. You want to talk about economic and how that ties to racial inequality, we have some historical basis for that in our state here, and we just want to identify that so people can recognize it and we don't go back to that.
1898, Wilmington, North Carolina, the wealthiest state, wealthiest city in North Carolina, majority black.
Yep.
Black-owned businesses made up the majority of commerce,
right.
And a coalition of black and white populists, not Democrats or Republicans, but a populist coalition was elected into citywide office, the mayor and a majority of the city council, shot out of office, a coup d'etat engineered by some of the most powerful white supremacists in the state of North Carolina, who on to become, in one case, governor, and in another case, the owner of the News and Record, the News and the Raleigh. Raleigh newspaper, and I'm conflating them with the Greensboro paper. Mm-hmm. So it's an important moment that story had not been told for about 100 years.
Yes, sir.
Until the NNO finally published it, and
right.
they did, and then thanks to them for finally telling that story.
Mm-hmm.
So this documentary now, Wilmington on Fire, mm-hmm. tells that story, and we're going to play a clip from the documentary now
okay.
that talks about how conscious the white community was, what happened, and
mm-hmm.
how it was that coup d'etat overthrew the duly elected coalition, and they understood then and now how important that was to the cause of white supremacy.
There would be members of the Wilmington Light Infantry in that room or Red Shirt Militia in that room. I would go in there and listen to them talk about 1898 and how they had pulled off the coup and how they had killed hundreds and hundreds of people and how, you know, they had taken over. And the words they used was, "We put them niggers in their place."
People here, they wouldn't talk about it. You know, it was almost like post-traumatic stress or denial. No one really would talk about it. And I had an older cousin. She wouldn't talk about it. Only thing she would say was that it was not about what's been written.
That's Kent Chatfield and Inez Eason, a clip from the documentary Wilmington on Fire. Kent Chatfield, an independent researcher, has done extensive research on the Wilmington massacre and coup d'etat of 1898. Eason, the great-granddaughter of Isham Quick, a leading black entrepreneur who was affected in that story. And I'm talking to Kevin Causey-Thomas, hosts the screening of that film at the Cat's Cradle in Carrboro February 18th. And we'll put that on our website, too, in case you missed it. So this is an important film.
Yes, sir. Yeah, definitely. Just to once again have the conversation, right, about, because this is what I noticed. We tend to have these conversations about race and inequality when there's a police-involved shooting or when something bad happens. It's like literally talking about your family problems at a funeral, right? It's like at a very stressful time. And we're saying, okay, in a month, in a moment where we have to actually get some information, have a conversation amongst ourselves, how can we move forward, right? How do we move forward? How do we make sure these things don't happen again? How do we honor that history? And it tells that, you know, just to have that conversation, that narrative around a good body of work, I think is constructive work. I think that's the type of social work that documentaries like this promote and why it's being received. You know, everywhere that it's been shown, it's getting a very, really overwhelming reception.
For 100 years, we were not willing or able to have the conversation about the Wilmington coup. In fact, it was known as the Wilmington race riot.
Right.
Until the truth came out. Are we any better off now? Are we willing to have the conversation now?
I think that we are. I think for the fact that I'm sitting here, the fact that Cat's Cradle, you know, reached out to me like, Causey, we would like you to be a part of this. We want to do this here. Because they could have said no, you know, and it's been at the Hayti in Durham already, but it's, you know, let's take this conversation to places where that narrative doesn't always happen, where we don't always have it. And I think it does well, you know, because there's allies in the struggle. And that's what I really want people to understand is like, you know, Black History Month is, this is why we're here. We want to enlighten ourselves. We want to educate ourselves, myself as well. And that goes for everybody about how, okay, this is what's real as opposed to what's being taught or not being taught.
Talking to Causey today from Intelligently Ratchet, today on The State of Things. We're looking at conversations this Black History Month that he will be listening to, programs that he'll be participating in. But I want to talk to you about something else, and that is the Super Bowl,
yeah.
which I watched, and right. I saw this, and I don't watch the commercials, you know, I just like do something else. And then I heard this voice,
right,
and I said, well, this is Dr. King.
Right.
What's he doing in the Super Bowl? And it turns out right. What he was doing in the Super Bowl was selling Dodge Rams.
Right.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness.
All right, it's archival speech of Dr. Martin Luther King. It was featured in a Dodge Ram commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. It should be pointed out the only way they got that was to go through the family.
Right.
So the family of Dr. Martin Luther King sold that to the Ram folks. But all the way around, I mean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, you enlightened me on that before the show. I did not know that that Dr. King's family had signed off on that. And to me, that's problematic as well. I think the whole commercial is problematic. Anytime that you try to commodify or sell people something using the movement, it's going to come off as unauthentic. Or especially that clip of that speech from Dr. King comes from a bigger, you know, speech that he gave about not being materialistic, you know. And so for them to, it's like, this is the thing that's trending right now, Black Lives Mattering and, you know, racial inequality. So let's ride that wave and sell a Dodge. You know, it's disappointing that the family, I talked about this earlier too, like a lot of times the family that's left in the wake doesn't carry the same moral standard. And it's unfortunate sometimes because they're left to carry the torch of the legacy. Right. And it's not always the best decision. I think that was made to get a check. I don't think that Dr. King would have necessarily wanted his voice associated with that. But it reminds me of the Kylie Jenner ad with her being at a Black Lives Matter similar type of rally and her handing a Pepsi to a police officer. Mm. the struggle in the movement is just not to be commercialized.
No,
it's
and that's
just not.
Exactly what Dr. King was warning against, that the commercial pressures are so great that they are going to undo social justice in the name of selling whatever it is the business of America is.
Right.
Talk more about the being at the table, because I know that you worked, you've done a lot of things in media,
sure.
including a stint with Hip Hop Nation.
Yeah.
Tell us about your revelations there.
Yeah, so I feel like and a lot of times when you get high up in these media and these entertainment environments, that people are trying to find a way to hit that sweet spot, that what you would call the hip hop generation, the urban community, that 16 to 18 to 24. It's like where the money is for a lot of, you know, corporate America. And so they try to find ways to hit that spot. And if they don't have a person in the room in that conversation, which is what I continually see, when I see an H&M ad with a little kid that says coolest monkey, that's not a red flag to somebody in the room, lets me know there was no African Americans in that mm-hmm. conversation. So I worked in a setting where I worked on the show Hip Hop Nation, and my TV producer, my executive at that time, I was the only black employee out of about 70 employees at that time. And we were working on a hip hop show, and it was a great show and a great environment. But when my producer came to me and asked me, was there a way to put Britney Spears in a hip hop show? It just let me know that this is the type of disconnect that goes yeah. on in these corporate environments, you know, because if you don't understand why that wouldn't fit, or if you're not respecting what we're doing as a culture that has different rules, you know, that aren't written down anywhere, that if you're not in tune with it, you know, that you're going to offend someone. And that's what I'm continually seeing, is people not respecting that this is a way of life for some people. You know, it's bigger than just the music and the baggy, you know, what people would generalize as baggy pants and backwards hats. Nah, there's a whole culture and a lifestyle that goes along with that. And it deals with respect. And so if you're not respecting, you know, if you're putting out something that's inauthentic and doesn't have that respect value, it's going to be offensive, and people are going to outcry like they have about this Dr. King ad, or if they see a cheeseburger rapping in a McDonald's commercial being offensive, it's just like, you know, this similar thing. I'm like, why would my boss ask me to put Britney yeah. Spears into a show? And these are the type of things that go on.
I know you're going to be busy with a lot of community events. We're going to put them all on our website to find out where you are and all the films and conversations that you'll be hosting. But I want to thank you, Kazi, so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
From Intelligently Ratchet, which broadcast on Facebook Live, we're doing that right now with co-host Bishop Omega, participating in a number of events at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.